popular history would have you believe, and look, there is plenty of truth in this, that women's roles were very constricted in Australian colonial history. But my next guest for this week's final Honest History discussion this year has been researching the role played by colonial businesswomen. And it's a pretty meaty one, actually, as it happens. Dr. Catherine Bishop is an historian based at the Australian Catholic University. Her book is Minding Her Own Business, Colonial Businesswomen in Sydney. Catherine, welcome. Hello.
Hello.
If we think this through, it's probably no surprise that women would take up the reins of business in the new colony because essentially these first generations of European women, well, they were survivors, weren't they?
Well, they were. But the other interesting thing is that when I thought that this was just about Sydney and just about the colonies, I started looking around, and in fact you find that women were doing this in New Zealand, in America, in Canada, and even back in Britain. If you start looking at towns in England, they're actually running businesses there too. And a lot of the women who were running businesses in England, they then just transferred them to Sydney, which is quite amazing. That was something I didn't expect to find. So they're survivors certainly, but I think they were tough cookies in Britain as well.
So talk to me about what you mean by business women. What sort of businesses are we actually talking about?
Okay, well, I had a pretty broad definition because you don't find a lot of women in the big export-import companies or the huge department stores and that sort of thing. But what I found was that there were women running pubs, they were running boarding houses, they were running cafes and restaurants. Then you had a lot of needlework trades, a lot of milliners and dressmakers and baby linen manufacturers, so very much that sort of female, using female skills. You had midwives, you had monthly nurses who sometimes midwives were doing it for free, but often, especially in Sydney, there were lots of them who were setting up in business and they would run sort of lying-in hospitals as well. And then I found an undertaker and a plumber. I think she was just running her husband's business once he died, but certainly she was running the business, and she managed to get City of Sydney contracts for the council, so she must have been doing all right. And then there was a taxidermist, and there were people running touring theatre companies and that sort of thing as well. So they were doing a whole range of things, as well as the general stores and a lot of those department stores, the big department stores that we know of now, a lot of them were actually started by women, in spite of us thinking that they were just males.
And really interesting that, because you might have expected sort of teachers and governesses and midwives and those sorts of things,
yes.
But that list, that's by no means always women-centred occupations, is it?
No. I mean, a lot of the ones who were in the more unusual occupations were the ones who had been in business with their husbands, or their husbands had been running a business and then they die and they basically inherit the business. So, for example, there was Hannah Coleman, who was in King Street or Castlereagh Street in the 1860s, and she's listed as an umbrella maker. And I thought that was quite unusual, and then I've realised that her husband had died and she'd taken over the business. But she still kept running it. Like someone else who was an ironmonger, ran the business for 10 years before handing it on to her son. So,
and it's just occurred to me literally this minute, Catherine, that my own great-grandmother, Susanna, was widowed, and in the interim before marrying my great-grandfather, she owned, I don't think she was behind the bar, but she owned the Wombat Hotel.
Oh, fantastic.
Here you go.
Well, it's amazing, because publicans in particular, I mean, actually, publicans are a particular case, because widows were often given publicans' licences. I think about one spinster in Sydney, one young single woman, and no wives were given. If you were married, then you couldn't get the publican's licence. It would go to your husband, even if you were doing all the work. But widows actually did get licences. And, of course, that made them quite attractive propositions for remarriage too, because the licence then, when they got married, automatically went to their husband. So your great-great-grandfather got himself a pub licence as well as a wife.
Well, she was also quite an upright person, and very sort of, you know, she made the final down payment on the church at Wombat and all kinds of things
goodness.
Like that. So she was, that's a really interesting thing to conjure with. And tell me about some of the stories that captivated you or perhaps horrified you. Give me a sense of some other personal histories.
Well, I guess one of my favourite women was a woman called Cora Anna Weeks, and she, I'm not even sure where she came from. She was said to be English. She started off in the States with her husband, George Weeks, and she set up a women's literary magazine, and she managed to get the support of the governor of Texas. And then she collected subscriptions for the magazine, and then she and her husband sort of published a couple of issues, but then skipped town and went to San Francisco. And then they did the same thing in San Francisco, and then they got on a fast boat to Sydney and ended up in Sydney and started this literary magazine, and it was all run by women and blah, 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 which was really just her. And then it caught up with them that she was called, the San Francisco Chronicle arrived here, and they called her a Jeremy Diddler in petticoats and said that she'd plagiarised everything and that she was a con woman and everything. But she still got asked to speak at the Sydney School of Arts, the Mechanics School of Arts, where very few women got to speak, very few women went there. But she actually got to speak there and gave a talk. And she was, I think she took Sydney by storm, actually.
That's
she sounded
fabulous.
Like she used every feminine wile in the book. And then she went to Melbourne and did the same thing. And the last I heard of, she was under an assumed name on a very, very fast boat to Calcutta, and then I kind of lose her. But I mean, she was sort of an extreme. But there were a lot of women. I mean, there's one woman who, she arrived as a child or a 17-year-old with her family into Auckland in New Zealand, started a dressmaking business, got married. The dressmaking business disappears, but I think she's still carrying it on because then she starts appearing all over New Zealand. And her husband, what was it? He said they travelled around sometimes together and sometimes separately when his affairs became somewhat complicated. So he was a bit of a scoundrel. Then he disappears off to Melbourne and she ends up in Sydney and she gets married to somebody else. Unfortunately, her first husband hadn't died. And so in about 1889, you get these headlines all over Victoria and New South Wales and New Zealand saying Harriet Causton up for bigamy. And she was actually convicted of bigamy. But she was only sent to prison until the rising of the court, which basically meant for one day, whereas the person she'd married bigamously got sent down for about 6 months hard labour.
Oh, that is absolutely brilliant.
She is amazing because then she completely reinvents herself and ends up running the Belcravia Hotel, which then became the Hydro Majestic up in Medlow Bath in the Blue Mountains. So it's like she's this extraordinary woman who just completely manipulates everyone. And once again, she's involved in lots of court cases where it seems that she gets money out of men by perhaps promising more than she's going to deliver. And then they get upset when she doesn't actually come through. So she's a very good businesswoman in a sort of a way. But, you know, but there's just these wonderful stories that you can kind of unpick. I want to have a time machine so I can go back and meet, well, I'm not sure about meeting these women, but just be a fly on the wall and watch them in action.
Oh, that'd be fascinating. My guest is Dr. Catherine Bishop from the Australian Catholic University. Her book is Minding Her Own Business, Colonial Business Women in Sydney. You're with me, Genevieve Jacobs. But Catherine, I hear various people cry, what about the children?
Well, the interesting thing is that a lot of these women had anything from between 2 and 14 children over the course of their lives, and as well as running these businesses. And basically, the ones who were most successful in business were the married women who were either working alongside their husbands in the same business or had parallel businesses. And the businesses were all run from the home. This was a time when your home was co-located with your shop. So there were people actually living in Pitt Street, for example, in the middle of Sydney, and they would have the shop would be operating out of their front room. And the kids would probably all be involved. Mm. It's interesting. Childcare and the whole child welfare thing is not such a huge issue, I don't think. I mean, I think that children were working too. You know, they were part of the business. They would contribute, and they would be running around under your feet, I'm assuming, while you were serving customers.
Now, Catherine, as we said earlier, certainly the overwhelming expectation in a social sense, even if these women are bucking that fairly substantially, is that women will be predominantly wives and mothers. How are they regarded by their communities at the time?
Well, the really interesting thing is I think it all comes back to class. If you go and look at, my PhD supervisor said, go to the state library and you'll find lots of diaries by women, and I'm sure you'll find some business women there. But most of the diaries I looked at there were all by the sort of women who took tea with the governor's wife. They were the ones who were the wives of the lawyers and the MPs who were ladies of leisure, if you like. You know, their role was to provide the social fabric, which meant that their husbands' careers were furthered. Whereas if you go back down a little bit further down the social scale, to the women I found were sort of working class. They were respectable tradespeople. So it was actually perfectly acceptable for a woman to be in business. And a lot of them were involved, like your great-great-grandmother, in helping fund the local church or being on a committee or collecting funds for some charity or something. So they did sort of perform all this kind of respectable kind of womanhood ideal, if you like. I mean, as the century goes on with the whole temperance movement, they become less so in a way, and there's more effort to try and keep women out of pubs. I mean, it's actually interesting because I'm now writing a book about colonial businesswomen in New Zealand, and it's a very similar situation. And there you've actually got the situation where they are actively banning barmaids by the end of the century. You know, they sort of, because they don't want women in pubs, you know. But I think it depends on who's calling you respectable. And certainly if you want to run the country, or you want to marry a lord, or you want to work your way up into the upper class of society, then perhaps pulling beers is not what you do. But having said that, there was this wonderful woman who was, she was well remembered by Sydney folk as being a bit of a good time girl in Sydney, but then she moved out into the country and ran a pub. And when she retired, she was presented with a sort of silver plate by the local community because she'd been such a sort of maternal figure, really, in the community, and sort of that sort of matriarchal kind of idea. So even if she was pulling pubs, she certainly had a role.
So, Catherine, why then have we forgotten this fairly substantial chunk of our history? And I, look, in this very same series of Honest History discussions, I had a fabulous chat with Claire Wright, who I know is a friend and colleague of yours, about the women who were at Eureka, and they were often in, sometimes very small, but in small businesses. They, you know, saw an opening on the goldfields. They were there because their husbands had the, you know, had the claim. But we seem to have almost completely erased these women from our social history.
I think part of it is that one of the reasons I could find all these women and put all their stories together was because of Trove, which is this thing the National Library have digitised all these wonderful newspapers. It has now not been funded.
Yes, yay Trove, fund Trove.
We need to fund Trove. So because of that, I could track lots of women through their marriages. So I could find out that, you know, Miss Smith, who was a dressmaker in Pitt Street in 1850, was also the same as Mrs. Brown, who was a dressmaker in George Street 10 years later, who then got remarried and became Mrs. White or something, and she was a dressmaker somewhere else 10 years later. So I could put those all together and do that for lots of women in a way that I think historians in the late 20th century, so all that generation of feminist historians between the 1970s and 2000s, they didn't have access to that. They might find one of them and think, oh, there were just a few women running businesses, but they couldn't find all of them, and they didn't perhaps understand that. I mean, they couldn't actually access the material that I have. I mean, the other thing is too that I think that feminist history in the past has quite rightly emphasise the importance of women's domestic role in as wives and mothers, and in trying to create a role for women in Australian history, they have said, well, actually, women were bringing up children and contributing to the household like that, and that was very important. And they weren't employed, and they didn't get jobs because people wouldn't employ them, and they didn't have education, and that's one of the reasons why we're still fighting today to get women into big business as, you know, as equals. And I think that because that was a kind of political concern, it meant that they didn't necessarily go looking for the women in business. And so we just kind of, and because the archives weren't as available as they are now, they kind of just got overlooked, which is why it's so exciting to discover them, because they can now tell a different story.
Absolutely. And fabulous to have your company, Catherine. Look, thank you so much for explaining to us all these fascinating findings about the enduring role of Australian women in business right from the very beginnings of the colony. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.